Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 10 days and 150 years ago, the vast bloodletting of the Civil War began at Manassas. These many years later, the State of the Union is, we think, strong. Southern historian James Cobb says that, paradoxically, Confederate General Robert E. Lee, who fought for the secessionists, had a lot to do with the healing of the Union. This hour on Point, how and why General Robert E. Lee became an icon. You can join the conversation. Are you among the many Northerners who admired General Lee, even though he fought for slavery? Why? Southerners of all persuasions, what does Lee mean to you today? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me from Atlanta, Georgia, is Professor James C. Cobb. He's the Distinguished Research Professor at the University of Georgia in Athens. He has authored several books on Southern history and culture, most recently, A Way Down South, A History of Southern Identity. And he has a fascinating article about Robert E. Lee in the current issue of Humanities Magazine. It's titled, How Did Robert E. Lee Become an Icon? Welcome to the show, Professor Cobb.
Hi, Jackie. Good to be with you.
Would you indulge me for just a moment? Over the weekend, I had the chance to watch the 1993 film Gettysburg, starring Martin Sheen and many others. And it's 5 hours long. I didn't actually watch all of it, but a lot. And I just wanted to play a scene from that film. Is that all right with you?
Absolutely. Yeah, I love that film.
Okay. In this scene, General Lee and Lieutenant General Longstreet are riding into the second day of battle, and Lee talks about the bloody toll of battle, and he hints at his later decision to give up a futile fight.
We are prepared to lose some of us, but we are never prepared to lose all of us. And there is the great trap, General. When you attack, you must hold nothing back. You must commit yourself totally. We are adrift here in a sea of blood, and I want it to end. I want this to be the final battle.
Well, of course, as we know, it wasn't the final battle. They didn't win. The war went on for two more years. Lee surrenders and then dies just 5 years after the end of the war at the age of 63. Sort of, and you point out in your article, kind of leaving the stage and letting many other people define Robert E. Lee. Tell us a little bit about how you think he became an icon.
Well, I mean, his death was timely for those who wish to sort of manipulate his image. There's no question about that, because he wasn't around to contradict anything that was said about him. And Lee himself had he was seen by many on both sides of the war as a brilliant commander, brilliant in victory. But he probably established his iconic stature actually more in the way he accepted defeat ultimately and resigned himself to it. He had at the very end he'd rejected Jefferson Davis's call for a continued guerrilla fighting because he didn't want his men to become, as he said, mere marauders, and he knew it would just cause more suffering on the people of the South. And he rejected any attempt to sort of erect monuments to him. He didn't want to have anything to do with putting monuments up to commemorate the Battle of Gettysburg. He said it was better that these kinds of the bitterness engendered by memories of that event would be best allowed to pass. So he didn't get involved in any kind of promotions. A lot of people, including one of his staunchest supporters, General John B. Gordon, a lot of Confederate generals got involved in commercial scams as front men for railroads and what have you. And Lee simply went to a little Washington College, which of course would later become Washington and Lee, as the president, and lived out his days in a very low profile in a very humble circumstance.
Tell us a little bit about the people behind what came to be called, this is a name that's borrowed from the Scottish Highlands campaign, the Lost Cause.
Well, the Lost Cause is it puzzles a lot of people because they can never figure out, you know, how people could be so enthusiastic about something that arose out of defeat. But It does, as you say, sort of have, it has parallels, the sentiment behind it has parallels not only in Scotland, but in Ireland and other places where they a defeated people find unity in that shared experience of defeat and actually find an identity in it. But the idea, I think, is the Lost Cause is not just some sort of romantic flight back into escapist fantasy. I mean, the idea is it rallies Southern whites around the idea that the their cause was still the noblest, even if defeated, and that they're going to sort of unite around this idea and try to rebuild the South to be even stronger and sort of, in a way, outdo the Yankees at their own game by creating a new Southern economy based on industry, the so-called New South that was championed by Henry Grady and others. And of course, in order to do that, they need a they need a symbol, and here is Lee, who had certainly been heroic in leading men into battle, and he was dignified, the perfect example of the cavalier aristocrat, and he had urged his people to do everything they could to promote reconciliation and to try to fit back in as citizens of the United States again. So he setting him up as the symbol of the Lost Cause was a really a stroke of genius. And all this is coming about at a time when people both North and South needed heroes. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got the scandals of the Grant administration and plus the corruption of the Gilded Age, late 19th century America, with all the trusts and the various scams. And so here is the selfless, noble Lee, who is a very embraceable figure. And, you know, even at Lee's death in 1870, the New York Herald proclaimed that he had already, the North had already claimed him as our own. And of course, what's going on here is that this is setting the stage for the creation of an economic network between North and South, the Northern capital and Southern raw material and cheap labor. And so this is there's economic benefit to both sides from such an arrangement, but what it involves, of course, is backing away from the gains that have been registered for Black Americans during Reconstruction, the various rights, the 14th and 15th Amendment, essentially getting the powers that be in the North to say, okay, we're going to back off and let white Southerners handle their own racial affairs. And so go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, and in your absolutely fascinating article, you write that, of course, the media was complicit in this, needed the hero, as you pointed out, and that former slave and abolitionist Frederick Douglass complained that Northern newspapers were absolutely full of nauseating flatteries of descriptions of Robert E. Lee. And you say that, that Douglass said that it's as if his military accomplishments entitle him to the highest place in heaven. That had to be painful for those who, in whose name the war was fought, the abolitionist cause, and African Americans.
Well, certainly. I mean, Douglass knew what was happening. He knew there was something bigger here than just the anointment of Robert E. Lee. That basically, the his people were being sort of sacrificed on the altar of reconciliation. But of course, a lot of the war had not really been fought in the name of that cause. And I think part of the problem here is that the base of support for Black uplift and permanently securing the rights of Black Americans was the power base for that in the North was really fairly narrow, and it faded pretty quickly when these economic opportunities presented themselves.
Mm-hmm. As they so often do.
Yes.
You write that in 1913, 53,000 veterans of the Civil War would gather, and they would not talk over the cause. They would talk over the battle. And, of course, the battles were so horrendous, and so many lives, over 600,000, were lost, that it does seem that a part of human nature would just be focused on that.
It does, and I suspect that there were a lot of people who were, you know, trying really hard to abide by the no discussion of the cause at the reunion of Gettysburg in 1913. But the idea is the great thing here is that both sides fought bravely and nobly and well, and therefore you should respect each other because of the courage that and the dedication that both of you showed, rather than spend time on potentially divisive discussions of why you fought in the first place.
Well, and it does set up 80 years of Jim Crow.
Oh, it absolutely does.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about how America, North and South, has embraced Confederate General Robert E. Lee as a hero. And we're asking why exactly we've done that. My guest is Professor James C. Cobb, Distinguished Research Professor at the University of Georgia in Athens. His fascinating article, How Did Robert E. Lee Become an American Icon?, appears in the current issues of Humanities Magazine. Welcome, Professor Cobb.
Thank you.
You start your article, by the way, with admiration by no less a person than President Dwight D. Eisenhower.
That's right. Eisenhower, of course, as a general, had reason to admire a fellow general. But again, I think the reasons that Eisenhower laid out in a letter to a concerned citizen who wanted to know why he had a picture of Lee in his office really focus on what Lee did after the war in terms of the way he restrained himself and counseled his fellow white Southerners to accept their lot and become productive citizens again. And of course, this is the Ike is the president. We've the Cold War is revving up and. We're facing all kinds of external threats and trials, and Ike suggests that young Americans should emulate Lee. That if they would emulate Lee, we would have no concern that we could meet any crisis that might develop.
Let's take a call from our listeners. David is calling from Stanton, Virginia. Welcome to On Point, David.
Thank you, Jackie. I appreciate the program. As you can see from my location, I'm in the, if you know anything about the geography of Virginia, I'm in the center of the Shenandoah Valley. And our local high school is named Robert E. Lee High School, even though Stanton is the birthplace of Woodrow Wilson.
Split the difference.
I'm 63 years old. I grew up here, born here, raised here. My father, grandfather, great-grandfather, all from this area. And if you grow up here, you grow up with the idea that damn Yankee is all one word. It's still, that's how strong the feelings still are here for the Confederacy. But as I grew and read historical information by Bruce Catton and James Robertson and other authors, I obviously came to understand the root causes of the war, and my take from it is that at best Robert E. Lee was a very tragic hero, but tragic in that he was a very apparently very honorable person, but failed to recognize what the root cause of the conflict was. He had gone to West Point, taken an oath to defend the country, and yet he in reality became a great traitor. And the real heroes to me are U.S. Grant and Lincoln, who, had they been lesser men and not shown the magnanimity that they did, we might have images of Robert E. Lee riding to the gallows sitting on his own coffin.
Mm.
And those, to me, are the real ones that we should be looking to as our models, not Robert E. Lee, and as great a human being, maybe, as Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson were, they compromised any kind of loyalty and honor to support a cause that had no chance in the beginning and caused all these deaths. And if they had just made a different decision, even with the political situation, they could have turned the whole thing around. Had they only made a different decision to support their country and not slavery,
okay,
we would have a different outcome.
Thank you for that call, David, especially being, as you say, a Southerner. Here's another call, Professor Cobb, that follows on that same line of thinking. I think David put that very eloquently. I'm not sure this comes from our website. It's a bit more on the nose. Robert E. Lee was a traitor. He swore to defend and protect the U.S. Constitution, collected a federal paycheck for decades, and when asked to protect the Union, he quit the U.S. Army. So that is another view that seems to not be a part of this movement that makes Lee out to be as heroic in stature as he often is made out to be.
That's correct. That's not a charge that was ever, you know, absent from the discussion of Lee. It was, on the face of it, I can't dispute that analysis at all. Lee, ironically, agreed with Lincoln that there was no real constitutional right to secede, and he didn't like it. He says secession is nothing better than revolution, which he was much more structured and hierarchical, and was thinking he despised the idea of revolution. But he did say from the beginning, from when the point it became a possibility that Virginia would secede, that he would, whatever happened, he would share the fortune or share the misery of his native state. And so what really happens is that he by his own action, is he's on the wrong side of one of our greatest moral crusades. And then in death, he becomes a, sort of a symbol for the wrong side of the civil rights cause. And it is. I mean, it is tragic because it's very clear that when you look at the way Lee conducted himself and the way he tried to use his influence after he acquired it after the war, that there was very much good in him. So he does become a very tragic figure.
Let's talk now to another guest. We're joined by Natasha Trethewey. She's a poet and a professor of creative writing at Emory University. She won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry in 2007 and the 2008 Mississippi Governor's Award for Excellence in the Arts for Poetry. And she's the author of Native Guard, the collection for which she won that Pulitzer. And as I said, Natasha, you are in Atlanta right now, right?
That's right. Hi, Jackie.
Hello.
Thanks for having me on the program.
Thank you for being with us. I have read that you have said in some of your poetry readings and discussions elsewhere that your side didn't lose the Civil War.
Well, that's right, Jackie. I've often talked about this at readings, how when I sit on panels about Southern literature and about Southern poetry, almost always someone in the audience will stand up and ask about the psyche of Southern writers, why it is that we write the way that we do. And almost always, even though I'm on the panel too, one of my colleagues, friends, all of them, will stand up and answer, well, it's because the South lost the war. And I often have to say, well, my South didn't lose the war. We actually won, and it's an effort to remind not only my fellow panelists but folks in the audience that there's a whole other South that, of course, as Professor Cobb has talked about in his wonderful article, that gets forgotten in light of ideas about reunion and reconciliation.
Well, in fact, Professor Cobb, I think you also point out that, and Natasha, you may have seen this, many more African Americans are likely to identify themselves today as Southerners.
That's one of the things, one of the surprising results of the civil rights movement is almost immediately opinion surveys start to show African Americans in the South beginning to claim a Southern identity, albeit you know, one that is differently defined and you know, differently represented than the one that white Southerners would typically think of. And so, no, I think you know, Natasha, whom I quote in the essay. Hi, Natasha, by the way.
Hey,
I think she says it so well, and that's what this past that we're talking about. You know, you often hear, well, black and white Southerners have a common past. That's true, but they experienced it very differently at some critical times, and therefore perspectives on it are going to be very very different. And you know, there isn't any you know, there isn't any denying that you know, we can't just make this dialogue about Lee anymore, or the Confederacy, or the what the white people did. We can't make that the dominant narrative anymore.
Natasha, would you just tell me a little bit, please, about Native Guard, which came out in 2007, your collection?
Yes. I started writing Native Guard because I'd grown up on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, and just off the coast of my hometown, Gulfport, Mississippi, is a series of barrier islands, and one of them is Ship Island, on which the fort, Fort Massachusetts, is located. And this is a Civil War fort that during the Civil War was manned by Union soldiers once the area fell to the Union, and particularly the 2nd Regiment of the Louisiana Native Guards, which was among the first regiments of African-American soldiers fighting for the Union in the Civil War. And I used to go out to the island every 4th of July with my grandmother to take a tour of the fort and then to hang out on the beach. And when I was growing up, there was never any mention of the black soldiers who'd been stationed on the island. And I didn't know this history as a child growing up. It was one of the things that was sort of willfully forgotten or erased from the larger narrative that we were given of Ship Island. And when I found out accidentally, thanks to someone who must have been a librarian, I'm sure, I began to ask myself the question, why didn't I know this other part of the story? And so I wanted to write about those Civil War soldiers who were stationed there in order to aggregate the story of the Civil War and that particular location that I'd heard growing up, and with the story of these African-American soldiers. And by the way, there's you know, one of the reasons I think I didn't know also is that when you enter the fort, there is a plaque on the wall that's placed there by the Daughters of the Confederacy that lists all the names of the Confederate men who were held captive on the island, who died on the island. But there's no plaque similarly mentioning the names of Union soldiers, either white or black, who were also on the island.
Well, how history is memorialized is, of course, exactly what we are talking about when we think about the Confederate General Robert E. Lee. Let's take a call from Rich right now. He's calling from Southington, Connecticut. Welcome to On Point, Rich.
Thank you very much. Hi, Jackie. Hi, Professor Cobb.
Hello.
I think I want to offer, while tragic still yet as a figure in history, I want to offer a different view than the last couple of callers did. At least the myth of Lee, I think, gives us a great paradigm for today's world. I kind of view Lee as somebody who lived out fundamental principles constructively in the real world. And you can see that both at the beginning of the war and at the end of the war, rather than see him as a traitor. Lee saw the constitutional union to which he had pledged himself, or the Constitution, I should say, not necessarily, as one founded in states' rights. At the his explanation for taking command of the Army of Northern Virginia, and for in the end defending the secession that he did not want, what was it? I must do is my Virginia. And in that, he was not a traitor to the Constitution, which he had promised to defend. It's in fact, you know, quite the opposite.
Okay.
And at the close of the war, I think perhaps you see the same thing again in his encouragement to have the men, and now in the real world of defeat, to at least make the very different constitutional construction that had won the war work.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that thought, Rich. Professor Cobb, do you agree with that? Do you think that he was fighting for states' rights and that therefore he is allowed dignity in his defeat?
Well, I think he earned a certain dignity in his defeat for the way he accepted it. But I think it's certainly true that North and South, the whole concept of the Union, I think, was different then. That we have our modern day conception that it is totally sacred and inviolable, the relation, the proper relationship of the federal government to the states. But Lee actually came from a Federalist background. His father had been a Federalist and had been, had exposure to the Federalist ideas of a strong central government. I think it has more to do just with the pull of one state that a great many more Americans than we probably realize in 1860 felt a stronger pull toward the state, toward their home state, relative to the federal state than we probably realize. And I think that's probably true of Lee as well.
Well, you say post-bellum, they would identify more as Southerners than antebellum, rather than before the war. But I also want to ask about this. His wife, Mary Custis, came from, of course, the George Washington's wife's family, a slaveholding family. And she felt pretty strongly about that.
Well, yes. And Lee became, in his father-in-law's will, he sort of became a slaveholder by default and did not like it. In the least, not because he was a racial egalitarian. He believed blacks were inferior to whites and made no bones about saying so. But he just was never comfortable in trying to manage the slaves. He wasn't a very good disciplinarian, although he tried to be very stern and was involved in some reportedly involved in whipping some slaves and what have you. But he was he did condemn slavery, and his defenders are quick to point that out. But he really condemns it as more of a detriment, that's doing more harm to whites than it is to blacks. But ultimately, the aristocratic marriage that he made, the estate was burdened with debt, and so slavery became a tremendous headache to Lee in his own personal dealings.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Confederate General Robert E. Lee and how politicians in the North and South used his story to repair a war-torn nation. And we're also looking at how the Civil War and notions of the South have come to mean many things to many people. My guests are Professor James C. Cobb, Distinguished Research Professor at the University of Georgia in Athens, and Natasha Trethewey, a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet and Professor of Creative Writing at Emory University. And I think we will go to our website. We do like to have your comments there. I'm reading from Facebook. The person's tag is Mark Equality, now Bernazzoli. Anyway, here is the comment. A former Yankee resident of South Carolina, I never realized how very seriously Southerners take the Civil War until I visited a friend in Atlanta and was standing before Stone Mountain and joked, "So, where's Sherman?" He whisked me quickly away after almost 100 people overheard and turned nearly murderous stares on me. I don't think Yankees know enough about Southern suffering because of the Great Northern Aggression. Take that for what it's worth. Natasha Trethewey, do you have an answer to that?
Well, what's interesting to me is the remark and the way that it attaches meaning to the symbolism of that monument at Stone Mountain. And it's that kind of symbolism, that kind of inscription on the landscape of the South that has often made me feel, in many ways, an outsider or outside the history of the South, because it's not necessarily a narrative that is inclusive. And so there is this kind of symbolic exclusion, which is also what happens, I think, when we are in debates in the South, in my home state of Mississippi, in this state of Georgia, South Carolina, about the flag. I can recall when Georgia was going through its heated debates about the flag and whether we would change it or not. Some of the things that I would read in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the letters to the editor, one of them in particular that stands out to me is one that the writer said, all true Southerners love that flag, the Confederate flag. So there in that one sentence, I was either erased from the debate or rendered unimportant or invisible, and not actually a true Southerner, even though this is my birthplace. It is the only homeland I know.
Mm-hmm. I'm just looking here. On 2001, Georgia's state flag included the stars and bars over two-thirds of its flag. The flag does fly on the grounds of the South Carolina State Capitol, but no longer on the dome. And the Mississippi state flag has the stars and bars in the upper left corner. But Natasha Trethewey, I believe you've had other symbols. You're a biracial Southerner. Did you not have a Ku Klux Klan cross burned on your property when you were growing up?
That's right. That was in Mississippi when I was a small child. And my family and I joke about it now because we are not quite sure why the cross was burned. There were two reasons that it might have been, and that was my parents' interracial marriage. We were at that point staying in my grandmother's house in Gulfport, and she had a big driveway, and across the street from her house is the Mount Olive Baptist Church, which during the late 60s was doing voter registration drives to get disenfranchised African Americans registered to vote. Now, the church didn't have its own driveway, so my grandmother used to let them park the church bus in her driveway. So it's quite possible that either the Klan was responding to this interracial family that was living in the house, or the fact that they were doing voter registration drives, or it might have been a twofer.
Professor Cobb, when we talk about General Lee and the South, is it possible to decouple heroism and glory and valor and things like that from some of the ugliness that absolutely and unmistakably went on under slavery?
First, very quickly, before the purists really overrun us, let me say that the stars and bars actually refers to one of the earlier national flags of the Confederacy. The flag that we're really talking about is the battle flag, which is based on the St. Andrew's Cross. And interestingly enough, one of the reasons they had to have the battle flag was that the stars and bars itself so much resemble the flag of the United States on the battlefield that the troops couldn't tell each other apart.
Thank you for that.
I'm sorry, but I thought it would.
I'm glad you did.
It saved someone from having a stroke out there, perhaps. No, I don't think it's possible. I do not think it's possible to decouple the whole question of slavery and then the further persecution of African Americans and discrimination against them that would be attached to the flag as a symbol. And I don't think it is. I mean, I think that's. Again, that's why I sort of see Lee as a tragic figure, because he obviously had some very clear virtues and strengths, but his decision at a very critical time, as I said, put him on the wrong side of the two greatest moral crusades in American history. So I don't think you can do it, and efforts to do it are just doomed to be futile unless you're talking to a very willful audience who just won't accept what has now become established historical fact.
Mm-hmm. Here's another very quick comment from the website. John Lee should have been executed for treason. Well, there's another John calling from Norfolk, Virginia. John, thank you for being with us, and welcome to On Point.
Hi there, and thanks very much for letting me be a part of the program. I'll preface what I have to say based on that. I was originally from the state of California, and my parents were from Michigan. My father was a big Civil War buff, and his favorite saying used to be that the Civil War was about a war for states' rights to own slaves, kind of combining two mentalities into one. So I grew up with a maybe less than ideal perspective of what the Civil War may have been about. So when I was thinking of joining my fraternity, the Kappa Alpha Order, I was a little taken aback to discover that their spiritual founder is Robert E. Lee. And professors, I'll gladly defer to your expertise on demand. Feel free to correct me if I say anything you believe to be inaccurate. But the image in my brotherhood of Robert E. Lee has very little to do with the Civil War. He's painted as a Southern gentleman, someone that valued respecting women very much and chivalry. He's viewed as a man that took responsibility for his actions, as a famous quote from Gettysburg, "It's all my fault." He was a man that practiced moderation, someone who had a moment of clarity and just completely quit drinking after that. And so in our circle, he's viewed maybe not as the hero of the South or the man that was the guiding image behind the Civil War, but more as someone to aspire to be like in the sense of his values and his commitment to
something.
Okay.
Thank you for that, John. But is that not, Professor, just what we were talking about a moment ago? It does take the virtues and decouples it from a great fact and a great cause of the Civil War. We talked about Lee as a slaveholder. We just talked about his you said his attitudes were that blacks were inferior to whites. And those things didn't come up in John's fraternity's list of Lee's heroic virtues, did they?
No, they didn't. And, you know, it's certainly possible with persons of less stature and less virtue than Lee to find, you know, many good things about him. But I think, again, this, you know, just decoupling him from and for that matter, the Kappa Alphas, who have, you know, they have changed a great deal now in the way they go through their rituals. But you know, they used to. There was a long period when there was a good bit of conflict over the Kappa Alpha Order's dressing up. I guess it was on Lee's birthday, and you know, actually renting horses and carrying Confederate flags and in Confederate uniforms, and which of course became, you know, was very offensive to a lot of black students on campuses or townspeople, and there you are, that you know, you all these things might be quite sincerely venerated were cited about Lee, but in the end there's still this connection.
Let's take another call. Steve is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to On Point, Steve.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
It seems to me that, Jackie, historians are always rewriting history, and they're not always writing it because of new research, but often because public sentiments change, political bents change. And so if the history on Lee is rewritten, it's not necessarily being written more accurately, but simply to reflect current sentiment.
And do you think the sentiment is changing on Robert E. Lee?
Yes, I think there is a lot of push to dethrone Robert E. Lee, and I don't think it has anything to do with actual history. I think it has to do with current sentiment, and I think there's also a problem here because people have been debating for 150 years whether the Civil War was really fought about slavery, because after all, 95% of the slaves that came from Africa did not go to the United States. They went to South America. So slavery was everywhere, at least in the New World.
Okay, thank you for that point, Steve. Natasha, when you move around the South and read, you just heard the caller from the fraternity and how history changes. I mean, what sorts of conversations do people engage you in about these kinds of points, what the Civil War was about, what history has to say now?
Well, I was really hoping that you were going to let Jim address that question about historians and revision and writing history, and maybe you still will. But what I would like to say is that, you know, when I was growing up in the South, and this is about how we have written about the conflict and the aftermath, the historian C. Van Woodward has written about the gatekeepers, the keepers of memory, I should say, and the glorification of the lost cause and white supremacy in the Old South. Daughters of the Confederacy, for example, were brilliant in many ways in terms of writing the history that they wanted to tell about the reasons for the war and the South's role and the vision of the South in the aftermath, such that they commissioned the writing of textbooks so that, you know, countless generations of school children were given only one narrative of history, and that was how it had nothing to do with the Civil that slavery had nothing to do with the Civil War, that slavery was actually good for African Americans, images of good old happy darkies singing on the plantation. They also commissioned the naming of buildings, bridges, roads, thus inscribing a narrative of dignity and glory on the South and excluding another narrative. Now, I've never been interested in overwriting the narratives that, you know, some people hold dear, but I am interested in telling a larger story that actually takes into account a whole huge part of the population.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's you suggested it, Professor Cobb. Do you think that there is beginning to be a demythology of Robert E. Lee that your article actually helps to propel?
Well, yes, there are certainly people who were involved in that much earlier than I am, but I do think so, and I think it is true that historians do respond to the forces in the present, and I think it's wrong for historians to try to rewrite the past to suit what they see to be the preferences of the present. But I do think, for example, you know, as Natasha, I think, is getting at a point, the most popular textbook in U.S. History survey courses in American colleges and universities in 1960 was one that still referred to the slaves as Sambo and actually said that slavery was harder on the slaveholder than the slaves. And I think, you know, when you're sort of when the Civil Rights era, of course, and we're led to rethink so much of this, you tend then to go back and look and see those textbooks and many of the books that were written about the Civil War or slavery, they're all written from the manuscripts and letters and records of white people.
Well, let's take another call because we just have a couple more minutes. Nina is calling from Long Island, New York. I'd like to get her call in. Welcome to On Point, Nina.
Hi, Jackie. I just wanted to tell you that my great-grandfather was Colonel Walter Heron Taylor, who was Robert E. Lee's aide during the entire Civil War. And my mother, who was born in Norfolk, Virginia, has always thought Lee was like a god. And
do you think he was like a god, Nina?
Well,
listening to this show?
Not having been alive when he was around, I see both sides. Absolutely. Right. I think he was a wonderful person to my great-grandfather and to his family. And one story was that my great-grandfather had four daughters, and Lee said, "We need some sons for this war," and he promptly had four sons.
There we are. Thank you very much for that call, Nina. Clearly a person who inspires everything from enormous loyalty, but as you said, it is how we write the history from these events. The textbooks certainly tell another story. And thank you for sharing your story with us, Professor Cobb.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be with you, Jackie, and you too, Natasha.
Good to be with you, too.
Natasha Trethewey, it's been a real pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you.
My guests were Natasha Trethewey. She won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry in 2007 for her collection Native Guard, and Professor James C. Cobb, a historian of the South at the University of Georgia at Athens. And you can continue our conversation about Robert E. Lee, who he was, how we see him today. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, or follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.